I'm of the baby boomer generation, and in many respects, the central chapter of my own life was the Vietnam War, and it's certainly the case.
Which you served in.
Yes. It's certainly the case that during the Vietnam War, and as a consequence of the Vietnam War, Americans back, let's say, in the 70s did not have a romanticized view of their military, did not have a romanticized view of war.
Quite the contrary.
Quite the contrary. But what occurred in the wake of the Vietnam War, at least in the story that that I tell, is it that changed radically, that a number of groups and institutions of varying levels of influence came to see the revival of military power and the celebration of martial virtues as essential to restoring American life more broadly. Or to put it another way, these were groups, institutions that viewed the changes in America attributed to the 1960s as disastrous, and they wanted to overturn those changes, and they saw the military as the means with which by which to achieve that.
When you say they, who are you referring to?
I'm referring to, first of all, the officer corps itself, the officer corps of which I was then a member, which, of course, had suffered a tremendous defeat in Vietnam. As a consequence of that defeat, the officer corps' own standing in American society was considerably diminished, and the officer corps wished to restore that standing. The officer corps needed to make an argument that Vietnam was an anomaly, that military power still retained relevance and importance. So the officer corps is one of these groups, but others included the intellectuals that we came to call in the latter part of the 20th century neoconservatives, the much larger group, Protestant evangelicals, who saw the 60s as a moral and cultural catastrophe. Protestant evangelicals wished to restore a traditional morality. They saw the military as representative of those traditional values that they wished to see come back into common usage.
You've also pointed out that in part this elevation of the military had a practical impetus, and that practical impetus being that we switched from a draft to a volunteer army. Yeah. And to get people to volunteer, you have to make it seem an attractive option.
Oh, no question about it. I was serving in the army at that time, not in any kind of a position of influence. But as the military attempted to recover from Vietnam, the perception within the military was that the draft was a problem. The draft brought into the military people who didn't want to be there. The draft brought into the military some of the pathologies that had come to be quite prominent in American life as a result of the 1960s, whether we're talking about drug abuse or racial tensions. And so the military believed that moving to an all-volunteer force would offer a way to sort of flush out these pathologies and restore good order and discipline. Well, in an odd sense, the anti-military portions of American society became a partner in this enterprise because as a consequence of Vietnam, as a consequence of the 1960s, there was a broad rejection in American society of the conception of the citizen soldier, which had formed the foundation of American military policy for roughly the previous two centuries. And so the bargain between the anti-military portions of society and the military itself was a bargain that said, okay, we'll let citizens off the hook. There is no obligation to defend the country. We will instead create what was called an all-volunteer force, but was actually a professional military. And the professional military will be the institution that will defend the country. And for a considerable period of time, in the 90s, let's say, this seemed like a good bargain. Both sides benefited. My argument would be that after 9/11, we ought to have come to understand that this bargain actually was an insidious one, not particularly in the interest of the country.
Insidious because,
in effect, the American people forfeited control over their military. The military is not America's military. It's Washington's military. And Washington, particularly in the wake of 9/11, set out to do with the military whatever it wished to do. And the American people had remarkably little say and remarkably little control. I mean, I would point to the Iraq War as, of course, the greatest example of Washington basically taking ownership of the military and doing what it wanted to do.
Doesn't the American public now, in general, wouldn't you say, view that war as having been a mistake? You certainly view it as having been, I think you called it a, quote, catastrophic failure.
Yeah, well, it was a failure.
You think the public agrees with that?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I suspect that if we, at random grabbed 10 people on the street here in Missoula and said, hey, what do you think of the Iraq War? I doubt that any of the 10 would say, boy, it was a rousing success. Let's do that again. On the other hand, my sense would be that the American people have rather quickly actually forgotten that war. There's been remarkably little reflection. If it was a mistake, if it was a failure, what conclusions should we draw from that mistake and that failure? My argument would be that one of the things we ought to do in the wake of Iraq, in trying to understand the implications of Iraq, would be to go back and revisit that decision to jettison the tradition of the citizen soldier, to ask ourselves if for this republic, for this democracy, for this great power at this point in our history, do we want to rely on a professional military which is not representative of our society?
Do you think we should
is divorced from our society, which empowers political elites in Washington whose perception of our role in the world may not be actually in the interests of the country?
Would the draft, in your opinion, solve that?
Well, my argument is not for the draft, but for a program of national service. And we need to distinguish between the draft and national service. The draft says that the state has the authority to command citizens to serve in the military, to select you but not you. A program of national service is somewhat larger. What that says is that every young person owes to the country and the community a term of service, and that service can take various forms. One form is that the individual can serve in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marine Corps, but that there would be other opportunities to serve, whether in Teach for America or the Peace Corps or a new version of the Civilian Conservation Corps, a wide variety of functions, but everybody serves. And my notion would be that a program of national service would do a couple of things for us. One, I think it would give us a military that would be, in fact, more representative of American society.
And more accountable.
Would close the gap between the military and society, and arguably would give us a military policy that was informed by greater realism and restraint than has been the case. There would be accountability. But the other thing I think a program of national service might do would be to enrich the prevailing conception of citizenship. It would make the point that citizenship does not simply entail rights, prerogatives, but it also entails obligations. And I think that we live in a time when making the point that citizenship entails obligations actually might be a good thing.
I have been speaking with Andrew Basevich. He teaches at Boston University, an author, retired Army colonel. Professor Basevich, it's been a pleasure to have you in our studio and talk about, as you call it, the new American militarism. Thank you so much.
Thank you.